Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Amelia Haviland, senior statistician for the RAND Corporation. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare tells us about a microscopic probe that can harvest living neurons from anywhere in the brain. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When California designer and entrepreneur Mick Ebling met a well-known street artist who went by the name of Tempt, the artist was already suffering from advanced ALS. Completely paralyzed except for his eyes, Tempt never dreamed that he'd be able to create art again. Unable to speak, his brightest hope was to be able to talk with his family somehow. And without insurance, Tempt wasn't able to afford the speaking apparatus that's been so notably used by well-known ALS sufferer Stephen Hawking. Ebling, raised in a family of philanthropists and entrepreneurs, became inspired to help Tempt. He formed the NotImpossibleFoundation.org and assembled a team of designers, hackers, artists, inventors, and engineers. They used only open-source science and technology. They bought inexpensive sunglasses from Venice Beach and various other parts from Home Depot, including simple copper wire and electrical tape. They hacked basic camera technology, mounting the camera lens on the cheap glasses to track eye movements, and analyzed ocular recognition technologies. Within just 2 weeks, they had a simple solution to Tempt's dilemma. The iWriter, an eyeglass frame-mounted camera that tracks eye movements and allows the wearer to write, to communicate, even to create art, simply with the movement of their eye. Tempt, who hadn't been able to draw anything for 7 years, said he felt like he'd been held underwater and someone finally reached down and pulled his head up so he could breathe. The iWriter was recognized by Time magazine as one of the top 50 inventions of 2010 and has gone on to inspire more sophisticated offshoots that will allow those who are paralyzed to communicate, even to create, using a simple, inexpensive device. The Not Impossible Foundation, forming a team of creative thinkers to group hack a simple solution to a real patient problem, creating a meaningful device that can change their lives. Now that's a bright idea.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Amelia Haviland, Professor of Statistics and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University and Senior Statistician for the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit organization that seeks to improve public policy and decision-making through unbiased research and analysis, focusing on health, education, and national security. Dr. Haviland, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for inviting me to talk with you all today.
Yeah, now you're a statistician for RAND Health, and during the past few years, you've been focusing a lot of attention on their health insurance industry, specifically on the growing consumer-directed insurance market, the high-deductible plans that offer a lower-cost option for insurance premiums, usually in conjunction with personal health savings accounts. Now, we just read with great interest your article in Health Affairs, this month's Health Affairs, on how these plans are taking over the private insurance market. Now, you indicate they project the projected growth in popularity is poised to save around $60 billion a year in healthcare costs. Could you first describe for us what's driving the huge increase in the numbers of Americans enrolling in high-deductible consumer-directed health plans, and why are they so popular with both employers and employees?
Sure. Thanks for asking that question. The main driving force around it is that they have lower premiums. So these plans basically trade off a higher deductible that patients face, usually earlier in the year, with a lower premium that gets taken out of people's paycheck month by month or week by week. And because of the continuing cost pressures that are imposed, because healthcare cost growth has been so steep over the last several decades, really, and that combined with the recession, meaning that there's a constraint on everybody's income, both for employers and for American families.
Dr. Haviland, your findings come with a bit of a cautionary tale. You've told us about why the consumer-directed health insurance plans show the potential and the actuality of savings, but perhaps at a price, because the analysis has also shown over time that while the plans certainly do indeed lead to fewer unnecessary tests and less overuse of healthcare, many consumers with these plans also may be foregoing necessary screenings and even treatments because of the cost, which of course contributes to cost savings, but maybe also leads to a poorer health outcome. Tell us about the downside of your findings that the high deductible plans are generating.
Absolutely. So along with the substantial savings that seem like they could be associated with these plans, there are absolutely risks associated also. Margaret, these plans place all the responsibility for making decisions about what care to get and what care to forego on patients. You know, these are the decisions that nobody wants to make. We don't want the government to make those decisions for us. We don't want insurance companies to make those decisions for us. And instead, what these plans do is they put all that responsibility, they place it all on patients. And those are complex decisions to make. And there are a number of American families who, when faced with paying their deductible, are constrained or cash constrained around it. There are huge challenges to trying to price shop in healthcare, right? So the prices are not transparent. Quality is hard to get information on. And we do find that there are reductions. This is the big cautionary note in our findings, is that there are not large reductions, but moderate reductions in all six of the specific recommended preventive care that we looked at. And they weren't big, but that's the wrong direction. So there is a real concern here about communicating with patients about what care to keep getting.
So unravel it, if you will, for us. You indicate if patients have skin in the game, they're more likely to be cautious about the types of procedures and care that they access. And I think the RAND has done sort of a seminal study back in 1971, following consumers for over a decade on healthcare usage, and sort of came up with the same cautionary note. So from your vantage point, what sort of policies do you believe would best address the concerns of patients putting off this necessary care?
We were really interested to compare our results to that gold standard, which is what the RAND health insurance experiment has been. Basically, all the research that's been done since then has just confirmed those findings, that when patients experience greater cost sharing, that they do cut care, but that they cut it across the board, that they don't cut it in the, you know, specific scalpel ways that experts would like them to, but instead they cut everything they can think of to cut. And it is a real challenge, I think, from a policy perspective to think about how to address that. You know, the employers really tell us how hard it is to communicate with employees about the features of their plans and some of the details of obtaining care. I mean, the story that we tell with these plans is, as is true for all health plans now through the Affordable Care Act, but these health plans were doing it all along, is that preventive care was covered. With first dollar coverage, the deductible didn't apply. Mm-hmm. And that's how they were trying to work the incentives, right? So they wanted there to be an incentive to get that care, the preventive care, because it was covered, but to have some caution about other care. And people don't understand that mm-hmm. that care is covered. Mm-hmm. There was a nice other study in Health Affairs where some researchers called people on the phone and asked them, what is your deductible cover and not cover? Mm-hmm. And people have no idea. It's just too much to keep track of about plans. And so, you know, there are some promising things that are about, you know, employers really engaging with their employees about the features of the plans, insurance companies really engaging with their patients around what is necessary care, you know, all the technology that's out there that can help with this, you know, but it's a steep problem.
Dr. Hevland, insuring the uninsured, those tens of millions of Americans, is obviously one of the chief goals of the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, we're all waiting to see whether the Supreme Court is going to uphold the act or the individual mandate. But I'm particularly interested in how you foresee the consumer-directed high-deductible plans fitting into the state health insurance exchanges that are being set up to meet the needs of the newly insured. And, in particular, is there advice that you would have for the exchanges and the states as they set them up on how they're going to educate consumers to choose wisely which type of policy based on your analysis and also based on what they're going to find when they're in the exchange about their eligibility for subsidies or lack thereof? Have you been doing any work in that area?
We have been looking at that. A lot of our study focused on the employer-sponsored insurance market because it's where there's data. Nobody quite knows what's going to happen on the exchanges yet. But the thing that is clear is that if the exchanges go up, that these plans are going to be offered there. There's been support on both sides of the aisle for that, and that they're likely to be quite popular, again, because the premiums are lower. And the folks who are uninsured tend to have lower income, so that the lower premiums are likely to be popular. The things that people need to consider, that it's good to consider when choosing a plan, is not just the premium. Typically, people think about the premium only once a year when they choose a plan, and then people don't think about it very much because it's taken out of their paycheck. It's something it becomes invisible. But the thing that can pop up at any time is that deductible and the out-of-pocket max. So the three things to really pay attention to are the premium, the monthly or weekly premium, the deductible amount, and whether you as a family have enough resources to cover that whole deductible if it were to come up at once. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is the out-of-pocket maximum, because that's the most that families would have to come up with if, you know, both they met the deductible and the cost sharing above the deductible, to see whether they could manage those costs in a year where something more catastrophic happened. And people who've run some analyses find that there are people with different health histories for whom these plans can make sense. So there tends to be some selection that people who are healthier join these plans because they don't expect to have many health care costs. And the health savings accounts that's associated with these plans can be a nice savings mechanism for folks who think that they won't have many health care costs. But it also could be true that folks who have ongoing chronic health concerns, that these plans can be a better value if they know that they're going to have to cover their deductible every year and they can handle that. And often the cost sharing after the deductible is lower. And so it can very well be that the total cost that somebody with higher health care needs pays could be lower.
We're speaking today with Dr. Amelia Haviland, senior statistician with the RAND Corporation, specifically RAND Health, an independent nonprofit organization that seeks to guide public policy through the analysis and research focusing on health quality, cost, and delivery. Dr. Haviland, you've also spent time analyzing how information technology is changing the way consumers educate themselves about real cost of healthcare procedures so they can hopefully make more informed choices. And it actually leads to more shopping around for healthcare consumers, which I imagine is leading to some of these cost savings you've been writing about. However, there's a lot of concern, as you mentioned earlier, about the lack of transparency in healthcare costs. So what's being done to address transparency and how is technology helping? I guess the question is there an app for that? And what other ways is information technology helping with cost containment?
You know, this is a really hot topic right now. And there's been a lot of growth in this area, even just in the last 3 months or 6 months. There are now, I think, three of the major health insurers who've put out an app for that. Where what the app does is it gives the enrollees some kind of information about usually where providers are, whether they're in the network or not, and some kind of usually rather vague information about price. And what I mean by vague is it's something like they use a color code. And in some ways, it's only the insurers who can do that because they're negotiating the price. They're the ones who know what the price is that somebody would, in their plans, would be facing if they were to go there. The other direction that states have gone is to require price transparency information to be public, where this is often at the hospital level, where they're requiring hospitals to post their prices, which is, you know, an interesting other strategy. You know, one of the things that we found that was actually different, which relates to this from the RAND Health Insurance Experiment, is the RAND Health Insurance Experiment found, and many other studies find, that with greater cost sharing, people just cut initiating care. So they quit going to the doctor for something, but that once they went to the doctor, the costs were just the same if people had higher or lower cost sharing. And we found that for the first time, that looks like it's changing.
You know, Dr. Haviland, I would think that one of the kind of obvious places where consumers might vote differently with their feet on the basis of these plans would be in the choice to go to primary care office, to the emergency room, to the retail clinic, and maybe particularly the emergency room and the retail clinic because of the obvious huge gaps in price there and the fact that prices are pre-published in the retailer convenience clinics. Have you done any research in that area, or has that been borne out in any way?
You know, it's hard for us to track the retail clinics. RAND Health has done some really great work on the retail clinics, and they are seeing a lot of growth. We haven't been able to tie it specifically in with the plan designs. And it was interesting to us that when we look at emergency room care, that's the one place that we don't see much change. And we were, because of exactly, there are big price consequences for going to the emergency room in most cases, and especially for ambulatory care sensitive conditions, that was one of the places where we thought there might be some unintended consequences. We didn't get statistically significant increases in emergency room use, but that was the one place where we did see that use actually went up, which is, again, on the cautionary side.
Dr. Haviland, we've had a lot of guests on our show focused in on trying to prevent system failures and errors in the healthcare system, Institute of Medicine and others. And you've been compiling data on medical mistakes for quite a time now. And your team recently analyzed the impact of the Patient Safety and Quality Improvement Act of 2005, which called for more rigorous reporting of adverse medical incidents. And this year, you also published a study in the American Journal of Medical Quality on repeated patient safety events in hospitals across the country. Tell us about your most recent findings in the area of quality and patient safety and your recommendations on how healthcare organizations can reduce these medical mistakes.
Sure. This is another area that's received a lot of attention. And one of the projects that's active right now actually comes directly out of one of President Obama's first speeches to the country, where he was interested in trying to look at connecting patient safety rates with medical malpractice. And the team at RAND that I work with on this is evaluating the pilot projects that came out of his recommendations, which follows on actually some work that we were doing, where we found in California that if you look over a 5-year period, that counties in California that lowered their incidences of patient safety events had fewer medical malpractice cases compared to counties that had increases. And it was about the level of, a change of 10 patient safety incidences changed, so if you reduced by 10, that there were 3 fewer medical malpractice cases, which gives a different kind of incentive to providers. I mean, providers absolutely want to avoid making any errors, but there are lots of people involved in a hospital, and it gives hospitals a really different kind of incentive to think, well, we could lower our malpractice liability risk if we can get these numbers down, in addition to just providing a better environment for everybody. And so there's some very interesting projects going on now that have systems where they're helping hospitals in particular to set up systems that support the medical providers who are involved if there is a safety incident.
Dr. Haviland, your team provides policymakers at the state and the national level with meaningful data that can provide a framework for improving policies and procedures, but also making large-scale policy changes in healthcare. And one topic that the RAND team has analyzed and investigated at length is racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare, which both cause suffering and also play a significant role in driving up healthcare costs and leading to poor outcomes for certain groups. I know you did a recent study looking at the disparity on really just a very simple issue between Hispanic and white seniors and the rates at which they receive the flu and the pneumonia vaccinations, and you still found significant variations. Tell us about that, and how does that lead to policy directives from RAND to the country's policymakers?
Absolutely. They are a couple of simple outcomes about flu and pneumonia vaccinations, and we were looking at the Medicare population, where there are really clear recommendations for folks over the age of 65 for getting annual flu vaccinations. So the guidelines are very clear on this, and there are public health implications of folks who are high risk getting immunized, and there also are real health complications for seniors that are associated with both the flu and pneumonia. And there are massive disparities for a number of Hispanic and Latino seniors in the U.S. compared with similar white seniors. There are also disparities for African American seniors, but especially for Hispanic seniors where Spanish is their preferred language and where there's not a long-standing Hispanic community around them. So there's some areas, for instance, in the Southeast where there are newer Hispanic communities, where there can be gaps, especially on the pneumonia vaccinations, that are, 40 percentage points, something like that, just massive gaps. And so I think it suggests that we have a lot of good information about targeting areas where this is a much more serious problem than other areas. And it should help with making efforts that can really hone in on areas where these numbers need to go up and speak to the particular populations where they need to have much more access to care and ongoing care.
Dr. Haviland, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Oh, brand.
Good answer.
You know,
good for you.
There's a lot for us to learn from other countries in how they're approaching their healthcare. There are some really interesting things going on in Costa Rica, for instance, in the Netherlands. There's a lot for us to learn from other places and other systems. And there's a lot for us to learn, I think, on technology from developing countries, because they're both are, you know, there's wide coverage of good technology here in the U.S., but there also are substantial populations that have much less access to technology. And so thinking about how technology approaches are actually working in some developing countries can be also quite useful to us here.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Amelia Haviland, senior statistician at the RAND Corporation, an independent nonprofit research organization that seeks to improve public policy and decision-making through unbiased research and analysis. Dr. Haviland, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm Mariano here with this tech report. Scientists at MIT and Georgia Tech have built a robot that will take us further inside the living brain than was possible before and could revolutionize our understanding of everything from epilepsy to Alzheimer's to drug-brain interactions. Georgia Tech bioengineer Craig Forrest and his team set out 3 years ago to improve on a 30-year-old Nobel Prize-winning technique called whole-cell patch clamping, a painstaking process done by hand that only 30 neuroscientists know how to do.
There are rumored to be 1,000 or more neurons in the brain. No one knows, but nothing up until now has had the potential to look at enough of them to discover.
So what they've developed is a robot that connects to neurons in the brain with a tiny probe at the end of the robot arm that can go deep into any area of the brain, a glass pipette, a tube, if you will, that is 1/10,000th of the width of a human hair, allowing researchers for the first time to record a neuron's actual genetic, electrical, and chemical processes in vivo, inside the living brain.
We have the capability to lower a tiny glass tube into any part of the brain of interest and record from individual neurons there. And when I say record, I mean we're measuring the electrical firing of those neurons. And that tells you a lot about what they are, what they're doing, how they're communicating with the neurons next to them.
Forrest and his team of collaborators at MIT were able, with the robot they created, to extract 50 neurons in a day from multiple experiments, when the manual process of whole cell patch clamping might yield on a good day 3 or 4 cells. This machine, Forrest says, will give them real-time insight into how the brain really works.
We can use this robot to, after we record from the neuron, we can suck out the contents of it into the pipette tube, into the glass tube, and then afterwards analyze the contents of those tubes and discover what was going on inside of the neuron while we're recording from it.
Dr. Craig Forrest and his team have been working with the robot in lab mice, but see stunning possibilities for human use in all manner of brain disorders, say, for instance, epilepsy.
No one really knows right now what happens to neurons when they have epilepsy at the molecular level, at the electrophysiological level. And so this robot can reveal those things.
And has huge implications for pharmacology and providing a window on understanding all manner of brain function that are still elusive to scientists and what they know today. The industry is already buzzing over this exciting new tool in brain research, really a final frontier in medicine. I'm Mariano here with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.